So we're going to talk a little bit about the short story today. That's a picture of Catherine Mansfield, who is going to be our main focus today. But before we do that, I just want to say a little bit about the short story as a genre. So I'm going to say something about the classic short story and then move into saying something about modernist approaches to it, and then move on to say something about Catherine Mansfield. I think the thing to say about the short story is that we think of it as a very well-established genre. But in fact, the short story as we know it today is a relatively new thing, which doesn't mean to say we haven't been telling each other short stories for a long time. This is E.M. Forster at the beginning of his classic study, Aspects of the Novel, published in 1936, I think. And he makes this rather dramatic point about the short story. I think he's thinking of a kind of sort of Neolithic version of the Thousand and One Nights story, Scheherazade, that kind of thing. But he tells this story about how vital, I think the point he's making is about how vital storytelling has been. So the idea of telling a story, of course, it's difficult to disagree with Forster, is indeed immensely old. Of course, I have an advantage here because I actually remember Neolithic times, and it was indeed like that. So I don't think, though, the storyteller necessarily was going to be killed if he didn't tell a good story. And that certainly isn't the case with the ones that we're going to look at now. Well, the point I want to make, and that's really kind of by the by, the E.M. Forster thing, but the point I want to make is that the short story, as it becomes established, and the genre in which Catherine Mansfield and the others are working, is a relatively new thing when they are working with it. And that definition by, well, it's not really a definition, but that attempt to describe what the short story is by Forster is not particularly helpful, I don't suppose. So we turn, of course, as we always do, to Chris Baldick's Dictionary of Literary Terms. And what we find here is this. I think this is quite interesting, actually. A fictional prose tale of no specified length. Okay, so you're not going to tell us what the length is, right. But too short to be published as a volume on its own, and he rules out novellas and novels as being pieces of prose fiction which are published on their own, so fair enough. So it's being defined by what it's not, to start with. It's not a novel, it's not a novella. A short story will normally concentrate on a single event with only one or two characters, more economically than a novel's sustained exploration of social background. And he's using that word normally in there, which is always a bit of a get-out clause. Short story will normally do this, so therefore sometimes it won't do this. So given that this is a dictionary of literary terms where you're supposed to be defining things, he's not actually doing terribly well so far. Fictional prose tale of no specified length, so we don't know what the length is, and we don't know what it will actually always do. It will normally do these things, he says. There are similar fictional forms of greater antiquity, and he mentions these various forms from different parts of the world, fables, lays, folk tales, etc. And they tend to be stories about moral choices, giving people advice about how to live, maybe. But he does make one very useful point, I think, at the end. The short story, as we know it, flourished in the magazines of the 19th and early 20th centuries. So when Mansfield and the others come to the short story, they're coming to a form which is relatively new. And what happened in the 19th century, as I'm sure you're aware, is that the proliferation of print and the increase in literacy generally engenders a position whereby there's a great demand for new stuff that's going to be published prolifically in magazines such as the ones that Charles Dickens ran, and later in the 19th century in famous short story magazines like Blackwood's, or The Strand, which was the first magazine to publish the Sherlock Holmes stories. So the short story, as we come to understand it, is something which really crystallises in the late 19th century. So interestingly, when Mansfield and the others that we're going to be looking at come to it, it's a form which is still relatively new, and one which whose rules haven't really been established. And as we can see from Baldwick's definition here, it still hasn't really been established. You know, a fictional prose tale of no specified length. Well, it's a short story, so it's going to be short, but, you know, how do you define short? We don't know. I suppose it's one of those things where we know what it is by omission, as it were. We know what it is because it's not something else. Now, here's Dickens talking about his Christmas stories, those famous stories that he wrote and which get wheeled out every year in December to warm the cockles of our hearts. And he makes this interesting point, I think, in the preface to these stories. He says, when they were originally published, the narrow space within which it was necessary to confine these Christmas stories. So, Baldwick says, short fiction of no specified length. Dickens says, the narrow space within which it was necessary to confine it. Now, I mean, of course, Dickens is famously prolix in his writing. You know, his novels are long. He tends to go off on tangents. And I think a common response to Dickens amongst readers these days is, well, you know, he could have told the story in much shorter space. Of course, in his short stories, that is exactly what he's got to do. And this is what he's drawing attention to there. He says the construction he found rather difficult because he could not attempt great elaboration of detail. So, as far as Dickens is concerned, then, the short story is a kind of mini-novel in which he's got to compress the events that you might find in a novel, and he's got to put those in within the confines of this much shorter space. So that's fine, and it gives us a starting point for what the short story is then going to become. And I think what we'll find with people like Catherine Mansfield, Jean Rhys, Elizabeth Bowen, what we'll find is that the short story doesn't really develop as a mini-novel. It becomes something rather different. It becomes more like a snapshot. This is Nadine Gordimer, who is a very distinguished writer of novels and short stories. And she had this little aperçu about short stories. She says, short story writers see by the light of a flash. Theirs is the art of the only thing one can be sure of, the present moment. So this idea of the short story as being not a mini novel, but something which illuminates a certain moment is something which I think Gordimer is trying to encapsulate there. And I suppose that's not too different, not too long a journey from Joyce's idea of epiphanies. And in the short stories that we looked at of Joyce, we had that idea that he was giving you a slice of life, he was giving you a snapshot, if you like. But there wasn't that sense of things being completely closed off at the end. There was a sense of kind of continuity, if you like, that there was that what we were seeing was just a slice of life, not the whole thing. So already, I think, by the early 20th century, when you get to Joyce, the idea of what a short story is being moved along a bit. And it's not so much the mini-novel that Dickens seems to think it was, but something more like what Gordimer says it is here. So if we can try and derive some ideas from these various thoughts from these writers, then what can we say about what the short story is? Well, we can say it's got to have something to do with length. The length of a short story, it's got to be short. And there are modern short stories which are less than a page long, And there are some short stories, for example, in this selected Catherine Mansfield, which run on to 30, 40 pages. So the length is a matter of dispute. But clearly, I think if you go back to the balding, the idea that you couldn't really publish it on its own, I suppose, is a reasonable idea. The focus is usually on a single event, so that, for example, in the James Joyce stories, Araby was one that we looked at. The single event was the boy going to the bazaar, and that seems to hold relatively well. Bliss, the short story when we come to it, of Catherine Mansfield, the single event is the dinner party during which Bertha, the central character, realises something profound about her marriage. So, yes, that seems to be a reasonable idea. The idea of epiphany, which I've already mentioned, seems to be something which is embedded in the DNA of the short story. A couple of short story practitioners, little snippets there of what they say about what the short story is. William Trevor says it's the art of the glimpse, which I suppose is very similar to what Nadine Gordimer said. Elizabeth Bowen talks about it, the short story being to do with peaks of common experience. That's another little thread that we might follow. Common experience. So in other words, the short story, perhaps a bit like the novel as it developed in the 19th century, is not so much to do with the fantastical and the magical, it's to do with common experience. And certainly the writers that we're looking at are focusing on that. And I suppose that's developed in a rather more formal way in that little extract from Drabble and Stringer's Oxford Companion to English Literature. The evocation of the larger human condition through a distillation of behaviour and experience. So in other words, the short story is going to concern itself with ordinary life, distillation of ordinary experience, but it's going to perhaps render some more universal truth through giving you the example that it presents to the reader in the short story. Maybe. So at the beginning of the 20th century then, we've got a genre which is established, which has an audience, but which is relatively new. And also in which the practitioners, the sort of leading practitioners, are not actually English. I would say probably the best known and most respected short story writer at the beginning of the 20th century is the French writer Guy de Maupassant. So it's a form which is ripe, you might think, for modernists to exploit and to colonise and to change and to make it their own, to make it new. So who have we got as key writers of the modernist short story? Well, these are mainly familiar names. Mansfield, who we'll come to in the main focus of this talk today. Mansfield wrote very little, or published very little, other than short stories. Virginia Woolf, of course, we know. And it's obviously her reputation is largely founded on her novels, but she was a relatively prolific writer of short stories, and some of them are very interesting, very experimental, very different. The other two women there, Elizabeth Bowen and Jean Rhys, come a little bit later. Bowen is writing in the 1930s and later. Jean Rhys, of course, is best known for her novel Wide Sargasso Sea, which is the novel she published in 1966, and that's about the it's a kind of retelling of Jane Eyre from the point of view of the mad woman in the attic. But that was a rather odd entry into Jean Rhys's bibliography in a way, because She's writing mainly in the 30s and 40s, and that was a kind of very late flowering of her work. So the stories that we're going to be looking at were ones that she was writing in Paris in the 1930s. She was part of that expatriate group in Paris at the time, and she was having an affair with Ford Madox Ford, which I think was kind of compulsory. You know, if you're a woman writer at the time, you had to have an affair with Ford Madox Ford. But it did actually inform the novels that she wrote at the time. James Joyce, we've obviously come across before. So those are the writers that we are concentrating on. We're not going to look specifically at any Virginia Woolf short stories, but you might want to look at some for your own enlightenment. Okay, so if we think about what's key in the modernist short story, then one of the things that's clear is that it becomes a kind of a way of experimenting with prose. So it's almost incredible to realise that Ulysses was first conceived of as a short story, but it was. And so I suppose that gives you some sense of Joyce's ambition. You know, that he's trying to write that as a short story to begin with. But more generally, the modernist short story does a lot of the things that the modernist novel does as well. So it rejects that idea of closure. In other words, it doesn't try to tie up all the loose ends. It doesn't try to offer a kind of perfect version of the world. It offers a vision which is perhaps a bit messier and a bit perhaps more like real life. So in Umberto Eco's terms, the short story is more of an open form. So in other words, it doesn't respond to particular generic rules, if you like. And we'll see in the different types of short story that we'll look at, that what you have is something which is very various and doesn't really follow any particular conventions. What I think is something that unifies the short stories that we'll look at is that they tend to offer that idea that I mentioned before, the William Trevor idea of the glimpse. It's just a kind of snapshot of something which might be significant, might not be, but it's not attempting to give a complete picture of something. The other thing, which is obviously something which has concerned us in all of our studies of modernist prose, is this idea of rendering the texture of human consciousness. And come back to Virginia Woolf's line about the ordinary mind on an ordinary day. It seems to me this is, and I mentioned this before, I know, a key passage in any discussion of modernist prose, because it does set up the kinds of experiment that modernist writers were trying to perform. Just to remind you, Virginia Woolf says, "Examine for a moment an ordinary mind on an ordinary day. The mind receives a myriad impressions, trivial, fantastic, evanescent, or engraved with the sharpness of steel. From all sides they come, an incessant shower of innumerable atoms. And as they fall, as they shape themselves into the life of Monday or Tuesday, the accent falls differently from of old. The moments of importance came not here, but there." So that if a writer were a free man and not a slave, if he could write what he chose, not what he must, if he could base his work upon his own feeling and not upon convention, there would be no plot, no comedy, no tragedy, no love interest or catastrophe in the accepted sense, and perhaps not a single button sewn on as a Bond Street tailor's would have it. I know I've kind of labored this point before, but it's worth mentioning again, I think, that Woolf suggests that if you really want to represent the way in which people perceive life, the way in which life occurs to people, then you've got to abandon all of those conventional structures. You've got to abandon plot, comedy, tragedy, love interest, catastrophe. You know, in other words, you can't arrange your fiction according to a set of conventions. You've got to try and represent life as it is experienced by people living it. Why is that? Because life is not a series of gig lamps symmetrically arranged. Life is a luminous halo, a semi-transparent envelope surrounding us from the beginning of consciousness to the end. And she finishes that, as you remember, with this sort of rousing call for the novelist. And, you know, we can include the short story writer, I think, in that. To take as their business the attempt to render everyday life in that way. Okay, so that's my kind of introductory bit to the modernist short story. Are we okay with that? Any questions on that? We're all right? Yeah. Right, so we're going to move on to say something about Catherine Mansfield. There she is. She's a New Zealander, and a lot of her stories reflect the fact that she comes from New Zealand, and a lot of them are set in New Zealand. But her main sort of creative period comes when she moves to England and also to Europe. So she's, and you can see that her life is a short one, but nevertheless, in that life she managed to produce a large quantity of short stories, and you may recall that last year a couple more of these short stories were discovered, and so there's a new edition of Catherine Mansfield's collected short stories, which for the first time publishes these new short stories. So at a very young age, she's about 15, she moves to England on her own, without her family. Her family don't actually like that very much, and they kind of call her back to New Zealand. But then she goes back, and she is free with her affections. She has a series of relationships with men and women. So she's an interesting figure in that sense, because she is very unrestricted, shall we say, in the way that she expresses her affections. She begins to write stories, which she publishes in a journal called The New Age. The New Age, very, very influential journal at the time, edited by a man called Orridge, interestingly, A.R. Orridge, and published a lot of modernist work. So she gets into that circle of experimental writers, which includes John Middleton Murray. John Middleton Murray is an editor, really, rather than a kind of fully-fledged writer. He'd had colonial service, and he actually wrote a novel about his colonial service in what is now Sri Lanka. But back in Britain, he made a living as an editor. And particularly for one of those little modernist magazines, you know, one of the many, called Rhythm. And so she helped Murray, she's later going to marry Murray, helped him to edit this magazine called Rhythm. And during that time, from about 1911 to about 1920, she moves within modernist circles. She knows D.H. Lawrence, she knows Virginia Woolf, who didn't like her at all, writes a lot of short stories and works on this magazine. She also wrote a journal, which was published eventually, and a lot of letters, which were also published. But she was always a rather sickly person, and in 1918 she was diagnosed with tuberculosis, which was not a good diagnosis in 1918. And so for the last 4 or 5 years of her life, she lives a very she lives a very, very constrained life. She isn't able to do very much. She's increasingly ill. She ends up actually going off to a rather bizarre sort of communal experimental place in France to live shortly before she died. But nothing could really help her. So she dies having published three collections of short stories in 1923. So a brief career, not particularly well known while she was writing, and in fact, since her death, hasn't been seen as particularly significant until relatively recently. But her reputation is now re-established, I think, and of course this new definitive edition of the short stories is going to help cement that reputation. So she is an important figure, but I think slightly different from most of the other figures that we've looked at, because her kind of sole genre is a short story. Which is why, obviously, her reputation is based entirely on that. She's not written about that much, but as I say, is beginning to attract a lot more attention. And I think maybe because she's seen as somebody like Woolf, who explored the representation of female consciousness. But unlike Woolf, there isn't an enormous bibliography of secondary material on it. And just as you might think that Woolf helped to redefine what the novel is, then I think it's fair to say that Mansfield redefines what the short story is. So I'm going to say a little bit about her approach to the short story, and then I'm going to say something about a couple particular short stories that we'll be looking at in Seminar. If we think of her as a modernist and the ways in which she used modernist insights and modernist ideas in her short stories, then I think a couple of things emerge quite clearly. That she's very interested in exploring human consciousness, and that she is also interested in the insights that psychoanalysis can give to that exploration. So you might compare her with, say, Mason Clare or Virginia Woolf. I think perhaps the difference is that, particularly compared with Sinclair, that she's not overtly looking at the kind of ideas that people like Freud and Jung were propagating. She's certainly taking those on board, but she's not as kind of obviously interweaving those into her writing as particularly Sinclair does in Harriet Freeman. She's also interested in how you convey human experience on the page, and going back to what those seminal words of Woolf about the ordinary mind on the ordinary day, she's very keen on trying to represent that, and often by presenting unmediated the thoughts of her characters. So she foregrounds the individual consciousness, and that means that she often then doesn't present you with a kind of detached third-person point of view. So although the stories are often, usually, in fact, written in the third person, the impression that the reader has is that you're exploring the consciousness of individuals. And I suppose the other thing that makes her typically modernist is that she's not particularly interested in linear progression. Now, I'm not saying that the stories are all sort of completely against that idea of linear progression, and indeed, in, for example, Bliss, we do have the events of a dinner party. We get the events of an evening presented to us in more or less chronological fashion. But what's contributed to the tensions and the thoughts and feelings of the characters are explored kind of in the background of that. And something similar happens in Je ne parle pas français, which we'll come to later on, whereby the you can trace the events in a kind of chronological sequence, but the way in which those events are presented are rearranged for dramatic effect, you might say. So she's not interested in a kind of straightforward chronological narration, and she's not interested in offering closure. So there's not, in typical modernist sense, there isn't that idea of having to finish things off, having to tie up the loose ends. So I think it's quite clear that she fits very easily within our definitions of what modernism is. So here's a critical comment from Kate Fulbrook's book, Catherine Mansfield. The reason I'm presenting you with that is because she makes quite a bold claim there, that Mansfield transformed the short story. And, you know, I think that's probably a reasonable starting point to explore what Mansfield did with the short story. Just going back to what I was saying before, the short story at this point is still in a kind of malleable state. It's not something which has settled down. It has its, you know, it has its kind of general conventions. But the idea of short fiction is a relatively new one. And so our writers in the modernist mode are making of it what they will. They haven't got as much to pit themselves against as they might do with poetry in the novel. So there's Fulbrook talking about Mansfield's innovative writing, the fact that it's attuned to the presentation of an unfixed and uncertain version of personality, communicated through unifying images. The images are very important in Mansfield, and she's interested, as a lot of modernist writers are, in symbolism. So, for example, when we look at Bliss, the short story by Mansfield, then there are certain images which recur in that story which have obvious connotations for our understanding of what's going on. So symbolism is important, innovation is important. She doesn't have this kind of fixed version of what personality is. This is the kind of thing that Woolf was railing against in her writings in modern fiction. You know, the kind of writers that she was setting up to knock down, if you like, were tending to write from the point of view where character was a fixed thing, and so almost a kind of two-dimensional thing. What Woolf, Mansfield and other innovative writers were doing were trying to get a much more complex view of what personality was. And that necessarily makes their writing more difficult, I think. So just kind of locating that within modernism in more general terms, we might think of Woolf in Mrs. Dalloway or To the Lighthouse as being somebody who's exploring that idea of a multiple consciousness and the way in which consciousness develops. Obviously Joyce. In Sinclair and other writers at the same time, that idea of the focus on interiority, in other words, the workings of the mind rather than the kind of external workings, and the unreliability of the narration. Particularly if you're examining something which is representing somebody's consciousness, then that consciousness is not necessarily something that we can absolutely accept as gospel. You know, so the idea of the authority of the writing is being undermined all the time. And that's a very modernist trait, isn't it? And it's there in Mansfield, as we might expect. So just thinking about how she draws all these things together. She takes something from all of those, I think. The focus is always on relationships, on personal relationships, whether it's husband and wife, mother and daughter, those sorts of things. And she is actually rather limited in her scope in terms of where and when her stories are set. They're all contemporary. A lot of them are set in New Zealand. Some of them are set in England and Europe. They all seem to relate to her own experience. So there is a collection of short stories, for example, called In a German Pension, which is a kind of bed and breakfast sort of place. And that's based on her own experience when she was travelling in Europe. She actually travelled at one point to view a First World War battle, which seems extraordinary to us. But she did. She went to France and sort of stood on a hill and watched people fighting. So her scope is not broad. You know, these are domestic scenes in New Zealand, domestic scenes in England, and a few in Europe. The emphasis is on the commonplace, an ordinary mind and an ordinary day. So these are ordinary people, and yes, quite a few of them are sort of a certain type, a certain class, so you're kind of middle class to upper middle class people, but nonetheless, these are ordinary people. And always dealing with the internal world of these characters. So quite often you'll read a Catherine Mansfield story and actually you think, well, you know, nothing really happens there, but you've explored the mind of somebody. So plot, in the traditional sense, doesn't really occur. And instead you've got this idea of life being observed, but through the central character's consciousness. So I'm going to finish by just saying a little bit about two of the short stories that we're going to look at. And the first one is the short story called Bliss. This is, I suppose, the obvious comparison to make would be with the first part of To the Lighthouse by Woolf, because similarly, this short story is all about a dinner party. And in this case, you've got this small company of characters who have turned up at the house of Bertha, who is the central character. And what we, as we read it, what we discover quite a bit about Bertha, and we intuit things about her relationships with particularly her husband and another woman who has turned up for this dinner party. There is a kind of epiphany at the end of Bliss, which is going to be of significance to Bertha, or is it? You know, the reader is left wondering about exactly how she's going to respond to what she's seen at the end there. The story has a requisite Mansfield symbolism in it. There's a pear tree which Bertha is growing in her sort of conservatory, and that sort of stands in for, it symbolises sort of burgeoning sexuality, really. And I suppose Bliss is actually about sexual desire as much as anything. But it's also a lot about the frustration of the ways in which desire, by extension, happiness, fulfilment, all those sorts of things, is defined within social parameters. Bertha is a bit empty-headed. She's married well. She's living in the 1920s in pleasant circumstances in a nice house in London with her nice husband. And her baby. And it's a kind of strangely modern setup, really, because it's clear from the initial few pages that the baby is a kind of fashion accessory. You know, the baby is not something that she has a great emotional connection to and is looked after by a nurse. So Bertha is a kind of rather empty-headed consumer who sees that, as I say, sees the baby as a kind of fashion accessory. But she's troubled, and the conspicuous signs of wealth don't indicate success in the kind of personal sense. And the bliss that she feels at the beginning, which gives the title its story, the bliss is arguably a kind of rising hysteria as much as anything. And I'm not going to go, because I haven't got time, into huge detail about this. We'll explore this in seminar. But the garden where the pear tree is growing is a dark and mysterious place. And gardens have their own connotations, of course, in terms of sexuality. So there's a definite sense that Mansfield is playing with the idea of symbolism and playing with the idea of how to represent sexuality. There's some very kind of suggestive statements within this short story, but there's nothing explicit. And perhaps the most shocking thing is right at the end, and even that isn't that shocking, I don't think. So it's a story which explores perception, which explores gender and sexuality, often through symbolism, taking place very much in a contemporary setting and using contemporary characters. So, I think it's sort of ticking all those modernist boxes, if you like. Je ne parle pas français is perhaps more interesting in a way because Bliss deals with sexual matters on one level, rather darkly, rather obscurely, but Je ne parle pas français deals with them actually fairly straightforwardly, quite frankly, really. And a couple of things that are different in this story is that you have a first-person narrator, not a third-person narrator. And the first-person narrator is a man, a Frenchman of rather dubious morals, who we kind of work out as we go through the story, who is basically a pimp. That's how he seems to earn a living. And he has fastened on to a young Englishman, and he's very innocent in every sense of the word. Well, I was going to say wife. They've eloped to France, but he's got cold feet, and he's gone back to France, but she can't. Why can't she? He's gone back to England. Why can't she go back with him? Because her morals are now... her moral stature is now ruined because she's run off with a man. So she feels that she can't possibly face her family and her friends, and she feels that she's now ruined. And of course she's therefore very isolated and very vulnerable, and she's going to be exploited ruthlessly by the central character. And so this one deals more frankly than the other one with sexual matters, and also sets up some very obvious kind of binary oppositions, such as sort of corruption versus innocence. But it's interesting that there's no kind of moral judgment here. The fact that Mansfield chooses to set this in a first-person style, so that we are experiencing these events through the lens, if you like, of this older and rather awfully immoral or perhaps amoral man. The fact that she chooses to do it that way gives us a particular perspective on the actions of the girl and her boyfriend. But also... dramatises this idea of alienation very well, because there she is, she doesn't speak French, je ne parle pas français, and there she is in France with no means of escape, and she is entirely dependent once her boyfriend leaves on this rather sinister and rather nasty older man. So the story has a, you know, it actually, in many ways, I think this story is more like some of the traditional short stories of the end of the 19th century, the kind of Guy de Maupassant stories that I mentioned. But what's different about it, I think, is that it doesn't offer closure. Again, we're left to decide what's going to happen. We don't know at the end. And in fact, there are alternative endings to this story, but neither of them offer a kind of definitive sense of closure. And we're left with this rather striking image of the young, literally virginal woman cast adrift in this kind of sea of corruption that France represents to her. And the fact that she cannot communicate, there's another great modernist theme, isn't it? She can't communicate. Je ne parle pas français, so she cannot express herself in this new world that she finds herself in. Okay, I'm going to stop there. I hope to kind of set you up to explore these in a bit more detail in seminars, and then we'll move on next week to Bowen and Rees. Thank you.